Set. Welcome, everybody, to the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation. For the record, it's April 5th, 2017. We've got a long list of bills we're going to try to get through today. And we're going to start off with opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 978. And Patrick. 968, excuse me. 968.
968.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 968 modifies the requirement for a trustee to foreclose a trustee by advertisement and sale, provides the definition of beneficiary, declares recorded trustee's deed to be prima facie evidence that all assignments required to be recorded are recorded, declares an instrument executed by a beneficiary as prima facie evidence that the beneficiary is authorized to execute the instrument, and it permits a beneficiary to designate an agent or nominee to act on behalf. The measure has an emergency clause, would take effect upon passage. It has no fiscal impact, no revenue impact, and no amendments, Mr. Chair.
Senator Hansel, welcome.
Thank you.
We'll let you back first, bat up first, and get back to committee.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Hansel, a senator for District 29, which includes Northeast and North Central Oregon. I'm also one of the sponsors of this bill. I'm here along with the Oregon Bankers Association to ask you to support and pass Senate Bill 968. The bill amends the Trustee Act to address remaining issues left unsettled by the Oregon Supreme Court regarding the recording of certain assignments of residential trust deeds. The changes would apply to all existing future residential trust deeds. They would also apply to pending litigation, including the case brought by counties against Oregon banks that incorrectly claims that leaders owe additional recording fees for trust deed assignments. Senate Bill 968 is important legislation to both our community banks and their customers who need mortgage loans. During the financial crisis, creative attorneys filed several lawsuits claiming that language in Oregon's trust deed statute was ambiguous. They claimed that mortgage lending practices that had developed since passage of that law might not follow requirements regarding who could serve as a beneficiary in a trust deed and how loans are assigned to other lenders or to the federal funding agencies, including Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Most of these questions were resolved by the Oregon Supreme Court in Nida case in 2013, but the statute has not been updated to conform to that decision. Senate Bill 968 codifies the decision of the Oregon Supreme Court and protects Oregon banks from potential lawsuits that result in those matters. This is essential if we want local community banks making mortgage loans to Oregon families going forward. Members of the banking community, as well as Paul Cosgrove, are here to testify on this bill and answer any questions you might have. Thank you, Chair Beyer, for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Senator. Is there any questions of the senator? Seeing none. Thank you for coming down.
Thank you.
Let's get back to your business.
Thank you very much.
Alrighty, so first up I have Linda Navarro, Jeff Sumter, and Jeff, I'm not sure what the first letter is, Gailey?
Bailey.
That's a B, okay. Welcome.
Thank you. Shall I go ahead?
Go ahead, please.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, first of all, happy Bankers Day at the Oregon Capitol. I am Linda Navarro, President and CEO of the Oregon Bankers Association and the Independent Community Banks of Oregon. And that includes the 40-plus banks that do business in the state of Oregon, of which today about half of those are headquartered in the state of Oregon. I point that out because when I started at the Oregon Bankers Association over 20 years ago, we probably had about 50 to 60 banks headquartered in Oregon at that time, and today we're down to about 20, give or take, because there are actually three that are pending sale right now. This is important because community banks, they are the source of 85% of agriculture loans in America. They are the source of 50% of small business loans that are made by the banking industry, even though they only have 10% of the assets. And oftentimes, as you'll hear today from Jeff Bailey to my left, are the only financial institution in not only the communities, but sometimes in the counties that they serve. So for us, Senate Bill 968 is an important bill for community banking. And I think in Oregon we need to do everything we can to preserve our community banks and to assure that they're able to compete and offer the products that community banks around the country are able to offer. And one of those is mortgage loans. Senate Bill 968, I think there's some confusion about it because there's a lot of technical issues, and there were issues that were addressed in the Nite case that Senator Hansel mentioned. But really, the passage of Senate Bill will not change the way banks make loans. Right now, if a bank wants to make a loan, a community bank, and they want to do that accessing funds available through the secondary market, including Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, they have no choice but to use an electronic system required by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. That's the case all over the country. And Oregon law, generally, especially following the court case, has been pretty clear that that's legitimate, and that's the practice that every bank in the state that uses that system follows. Unfortunately, however, there are some, I think the word was creative attorneys that Senator Hansel mentioned, really a creative attorney that has been working with counties to file lawsuits against banks, banks like the gentleman here to my left. And you'll hear a little bit more from them directly about what that looks like and what it's done. We believe Senate Bill 968 clarifies the law to avoid such litigation in the future, because community banks don't have the size and the scope to manage litigation risk for making loans in the only fashion they're allowed to make them, in the same way that they can manage the credit risk that they're so good at managing. So I again say that passage of this bill truly will not change the way consumers, your constituents, get loans from local banks, but not passing the bill means that some of these local banks will stop making mortgage loans. And I don't think we need community banks stopping making mortgage loans when in many respects you could argue those are the safest and soundest places for a person to be able to go and get a loan. And these loans, by the way, that are through Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are generally the 30-year fixed-rate mortgages with the lowest interest available. So what you're doing when you pass this bill is making it clear that a bank following a system that's used all over the country for making loans in partnership with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac is not going to turn around and get sued for those loans. So with that, I will pause and turn it over to my colleagues, but I'm also happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Linda.
Okay. Please, sir. Chair Beyer and members of the committee, my name is Jeff Bailey. I'm president and CEO of Bank of Eastern Oregon, headquartered in Heppner, Oregon. We have branches or loan offices in 12 Eastern Oregon counties. I'm also current chairman of the Oregon Bankers Association, and I'm here to speak in favor of Senate Bill 968. Locally owned and operated community-based banks are critical to the local economies. In many of our communities, we are the only bank in town. In fact, in three counties, we are the only bank in the county. I tell you this to point out that in rural markets, we are often the only local alternative for customers in getting a home mortgage. All qualifying borrowers should have access to long-term fixed-rate loans. To provide this mortgage loan product to customers, we must deal with requirements set forth by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. These systems require banks to follow their rules to provide the 30-year lower fixed-rate loans that our customers, your constituents, want and deserve. The goal of this bill is to clarify the statute, maintain that access to Freddie and Fannie, the products, and ultimately continue providing customers with a viable mortgage product. As a bank and as bankers, we handle credit risk every day. We understand that, we get it, we expect it. But there's another type of risk that is more difficult to handle. It is the unknown and unexpected litigation risk coming from third parties, those third parties that aren't even associated with the loan. This bill will help clarify the statute and lessen the chance of expensive litigation. expensive by way of attorney fees and staff time, as well as expense of documentation and research to defend these frivolous lawsuits. I'm asking you to please support Senate Bill 968 and protect community-based mortgage lending in Oregon.
Thank you, Chairman Byer, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Sumter. I'm the co-president and CEO of Lewis and Clark Bank, headquartered in Oregon City. We're also a community bank. We have loan production offices in Klamath Falls and Bend as well. So we do have offices around the state. I agree with everything that Jeff said. I can add maybe a little bit different flavor on it. Our bank was in the first round of lawsuits that came from Multnomah County on this very issue. And so I can give you what our experience was. As a community bank, we also have to be part of that system to provide the best rate 30-year fixed rate mortgages for our clients. And it's really not as much or wasn't as much of a business line for us as it was an accommodation to take care of our customers. And during that time, we had in Multnomah County, anyway, not in total, but in Multnomah County, we had done three mortgage loans for two clients. One client had two loans, and we were named in the suit. And it was rather indiscriminate how banks were named. Several small banks were in there, and it cost my bank over $50,000 just in direct costs, not counting time, to defend three mortgage loans that we did as accommodation to take care of customers. And we don't have commission loan officers for the mortgage business. That's not really our primary business. It's just, you know, something we did to do to take care of the clients. And Jeff mentioned the word frivolous. I can't stress that enough when you have that kind of risk. So what our reaction, the board of directors of our bank decided post suit was to actually get out of that business. That is a risk that we can't quantify. And I think this bill will go a long way to clearing that up. And, you know, something that we can take that risk off, at least the litigation risk of third parties, off the table. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Thompson.
What were you, if you can tell, say, what were you, what was the lawsuit for? What were you suing?
Well, it had to do, as Linda said, with recording fees and the alleging that recordings did not happen and counties did not get recording fees on loans as they transferred hands, you know, as they get sold around. What I don't understand, though, is that at origination, when we take care of our client, the recording fee gets paid. So to say that there was recordings in the future that didn't happen because there's a beneficiary, being the electronic registration system, that's other investors, Fannie, Freddie, you know, as those loans change hands. So at origination, all fees, all recording was paid by any of the community banks that originated the mortgage.
Okay. Other questions?
I'm going to throw a question out there because I know it's going to come up looking at the list that's here. And one of those, it goes back to the banking, not so much banking, the mortgage crisis that we had during the downturn. And one of the issues that the legislature dealt with before then was, and it was with the electronic MERS system, the law and what the courts ruled is that every time you move ownership of the note, it needs to be recorded. The ownership change needs to be recorded. And I think that the issue was that those separate recordings weren't recorded. And I suspect that's what we're going to hear. One of the results of that process was that in a lot of the foreclosures that was happening at that time, the customer who had the mortgage didn't know who the agent was that they were talking with, and it changed a number of times. So I think that's the issue that's probably going to be raised.
Senator Byer, members of the committee. You know, I think that's a separate issue. And Paul Cosgrove, who I think you know, and is right behind me.
Yeah, I've seen him standing.
Trade places with him, and he can give you the more technical answer. I would just say, however, that we go back to the fact that this electronic registration system, you referred to MERS, is the only choice for a lender that wants to originate loans for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. You cannot not use that system. So if that system is not acceptable because it doesn't pay local county recording fees every time there's a change in hands, we can't help that. If you want Oregonians to have access to mortgage loans, especially at community banks that don't have other options for originating those loans, then we've got to use that system. And if that impacts county recording fees after the bank has already paid theirs and sold the loan, that is something that this bill doesn't change. So I would, if you don't mind, step back, because I have a feeling you're going to ask a follow-up.
I want to clarify there. Are you saying that Fannie and Freddie require that you use MERS?
For a community bank to be able to access the secondary market, you have to be a member of MERS. And they have different statuses now of membership, that is a requirement. Those loans all get all use that electronic system to register the loans. That's correct, Senator.
Mr. Chair, Paul Cosgrove, representing the Oregon Bankers Association Independent Community Banks. In response to your comment, you're correct. The situation, as you describe it, was that before the court ruled in this Oregon Supreme Court ruled. And there were cases all over the map about whether this system was legitimate or not. The Oregon Supreme Court ruled that the system is legitimate. And the only thing you have to prove before you foreclose is the person foreclosing the legal owner of the note and the trustee being foreclosed. And the court did not find it necessary to delve into any intermediate assignments. What's at issue in these new suits is, are counties owed recording fees for things that weren't recorded? It's a fee for service. And the transfers have been made in an electronic system, so they weren't recorded. The county didn't have the work to record it and didn't get the fee to cover the work to record it. And that's the issue in the new lawsuits. It's really a different issue than what was happening back in the time you were referring to, where borrowers were saying, because the law was unclear before the Supreme Court ruled, that the system was not legitimate. That's what borrowers were arguing, and some courts ruled in their favor and some courts ruled against them. But that legitimacy of the system as a whole was pretty much settled by the Oregon Supreme Court. What this bill does is nothing more than codify what the Oregon Supreme Court has decided, plus clarify this last issue, and I can even show you, if you wish, which sentence it is in the bill, that we do not have to record things that don't change the beneficiary if there's assignments that don't change the beneficiary, which is exactly what happens in MERS. We do have to record at the end. We do have to record at the beginning. And that's the issue in these two new lawsuits, the one in Multnomah County, which was settled, and the one now for the other counties that is pending. I just point out, we're talking about big dollars here that are potentially at risk for community banks. The prayer in that complaint and the allegations are fraud and all sorts of misrepresentation, which I think is a real stretch. But the prayer is for $50 million. And that's a tremendous risk if you're a small community bank and looking at this. And as has been pointed out, there's no rhyme or reason for who was picked as defendants. For example, one of the charter members, early members of MERS, was the Oregon State Employees Credit Union. They're not named. Banks in the first suit that were named are not named in the second suit, and vice versa. So it's really, I think, the uncertainty of this that's causing the disruption within the industry and causing community banks, as you've just heard, to get out of the business, and that's not good for consumers. So I would just point out that I've heard as of today that there may be some concerns that this seems to do certain things, like change the mediation program. Not intended to do that, and if somebody can point out to me where we have unintentionally done that, we'll fix it. Or change any rights of borrowers with respect to the loans with their lenders, not intended to do that, and if there is anything there, we'll change it. So my only request is, let's try to make sure we're concentrating on what we're trying to do and not worried about things that might happen, because if they might happen and this bill causes that to be a problem, we'll fix that.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. I think, well, let's get DOJ up here. Janet Booth, Cheryl, and Sybil Hipp. Welcome.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Cheryl Heemstra. I'm the Deputy Legislative Director at the Oregon Department of Justice. This bill gets complicated pretty quick, so I brought some help with me today. This is Assistant Attorney General Janet Borth. You may recall Janet. She was around for the foreclosure crisis and helped a lot with the foreclosure avoidance mediation program and a lot of the good work that you did back then. We are here today in opposition of Senate Bill 968. We think that it goes probably much broader than just the origination of loans issue that you just heard about. We're really worried about the effect it will have on the public and the consumers in Oregon. So first of all, I'd like to mention the case law and the law going back, tying together the loan with the beneficiary goes back a long ways, and there's a good reason for that. We want to know who owns land in Oregon. This is a very basic thing. This is the very home that the very dirt that your homes are on. We want to be clear about who owns it. And so sort of separating those out, which is what this bill would do, is very concerning to us. If you look at the bill at the beginning, for the new definition of beneficiary, it includes the word beneficiary. We find that to be very confusing. You can basically just say the beneficiary is the beneficiary. That's not going to provide any clarity to people who are owning these homes about who is foreclosing upon them in the most serious case. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Janet to give you kind of the technical issues we have and how this is going to affect our foreclosure avoidance settlement program. And so with that, I'll turn it over.
Thank you. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Janet Borth, and I'm an assistant attorney general with the Oregon Department of Justice. I know we have a full schedule, so I'll try to be brief and just hit a few points. First, in Section 1, as Ms. Heemstra mentioned, the redefinition of beneficiary is far more circular than it once was. A beneficiary is who the beneficiary says they are. We would be removing the existing requirement that it's the person for whose benefit a trust deed is given. Why does that matter? It moves us even further towards an honor system. And we have honor systems in the law. We have affidavits, but we don't have a way of determining whether you got it right, because there is no additional information provided. It conceals the underlying.
I'm lost on that.
Yeah, sorry. Let me try again. Under the current definition, a beneficiary who has all these rights going forward is the person for whose benefit a trust deed is given. So they're the person who has the deed. So
it's the owner?
It's the lender initially. And now the beneficiary is whoever is written into the box that says beneficiary. You don't have to have any kind of special status.
Or interest.
So you no longer have to actually have an interest in the property. You can be, Ms. Harpster described it as, you could theoretically put a straw man in, and now your straw man, who's not actually the lender, has all the power over what happens to the note going forward.
Does this get to the issue of what we had in the past of the robo?
It does, yeah. So if I can kind of, I apologize. We did have concerns with robo-signing in the past, and so whereas now you have to prove up that you have an interest in the note, going forward you have to prove up that you signed an affidavit saying that you are the beneficiary. So that's part of where it gets confusing, is you self-define your interest instead of having any sort of external criteria proving that you have an interest. So I can see that I'm losing you, and I apologize.
It's kind of like, technical. And so why is that important?
Yeah. Let me see if, you know, Kelly Harpster, I'm going to see if I can find someone who's able to be a little bit more clear.
And if I might, Chair, maybe while Ms. Borth is doing that, and I apologize, I should have jumped in because I was going to try to sort of provide some background and context.
And you are?
Thank you. Oh, so sorry. Apologies, Chair. My name is Sybil Hebben with the Oregon Law Center, and we also have concerns with Senate Bill 968. The Oregon Law Center, as you all know, provides civil legal assistance to low-income people. It didn't used to be the fact that, or the case, that any of our clients, really, for the most part, were homeowners. That changed drastically in around 2005, 2006, as suddenly the foreclosure crisis hit, and suddenly people who formerly, you know, they were working people, homeowners, didn't used to be low enough income to qualify for our services, and suddenly they were underwater. Suddenly they were coming to our offices because they were in the midst of foreclosure proceedings, and they couldn't figure out sort of who their lender was, who the person was who owned their home or their loan, and they weren't able to get any response from the bank when they were, or from the servicer when they were trying to work out a modification or a negotiation or a payment plan or some alternative to foreclosure. So we had people just sort of getting foreclosed on and losing their homes right and left, and we all know how that crisis ended up impacting many families and also communities in our states. And so that's sort of when the legal aid started looking at foreclosure. And I should say as a caveat that I am not, unfortunately, a technical expert. I've never practiced in this area. So I've consulted with folks who do have expertise, and I've gone back and read through all the records from our case files and the good work that, that this legislature has done, basically going back as far as 2009, and then also when the mortgage servicing regulations were passed by the legislature, and then also in 2012 and 13 when the foreclosure mediation program was passed. And both of those efforts were the result of really a lot of work by agencies as well as consumer protection advocates, and there was bipartisan support for those approaches, and I'm grateful to be able to say that I think those approaches were very effective. I don't think that we are through the foreclosure crisis, and I think there are still 10,000 Oregonians that are more than 90 days delinquent on their loans, and the foreclosure mediation program still has 600 cases coming through or involved in that program per month. So this is still an issue that's really impacting our clients and our communities, but because of some of the good work that was done by this legislature, as well as that we think was done by the Supreme Court in the Brandrup case, which I think is the same case that they're referring to as that other witnesses referred to as NIDE. They got kind of bundled together in the Supreme Court and decided together. And as a result of that Supreme Court case, it became very clear that folks could not, or lenders could not, go through the non-judicial foreclosure process outside of a court's oversight unless they had recorded all of the changes in the chain of title throughout the process. And recording is important from our perspective because we want to make sure that there is a publicly available, transparent, and accurate system of documentation of where property is and who owns the interest. And if we, so MERS as an entity is this electronic data system. I personally have no objection to the idea of an electronic data system. I worry if there is a system that is industry owned. It's not a public entity. It's a private entity. It's a fee for, you know, I can't access it just as an independent random person, member of the public, and there have been significant inaccuracies with the way in which those records have been kept in the past. And so my concern is not with respect to, I don't actually know anything about the lawsuit that was referred to previously, but the concern that Legal Aid has is making sure that whatever the system is that we're using to record and keep track of property interests, we want to make sure that it's reliable, that it's publicly accessible, and that it's accurate. And as a result of the Brandrup decision and as a result of legislative action in prior sessions, it became clear that lenders could not go through the foreclosure process administratively through the non-judicial foreclosure process. They had to use the court process. From a consumer perspective, that works fine for us. And the judges, you know, if there's third-party entity sort of overseeing what the proof is that the person who is foreclosing actually has the right to foreclose and that proceeding through that judicial process is going to end up in a final decision, you know, we may not like the decision, maybe the consumer loses, but if it's a final decision and it was made in favor of the person who actually owns the loan, that's justice. And so so I think the concerns that we have about Senate Bill 968 are that it seems to separate the interest of the in the note and in the property. So they're different entities, and the person who holds the note doesn't necessarily or holds the title isn't the same person who holds the note and who is owed the loan. And that is a concern. It goes back to the worries that we had initially prior to the or at the height of the foreclosure crisis when we heard from borrowers and they couldn't negotiate. They didn't know who their point person was. So we would have concerns about any changes in the statute that would have that impact. The other piece, I think there was a mention of sort of what the impact would be on the foreclosure mediation program. The way I read the bill, and there's a provision in it, and I apologize, I don't have a copy of it with me here, but it essentially changes the law that says that you may not follow through with the court process, the foreclosure process, if the borrower is in compliance with a foreclosure mediation or an alternative to foreclosure, an agreement or a modification. And that seems like a fairly substantial reversal of what is currently a borrower's right to enter into a negotiation through the mediation program. So we'd be worried about that. I guess in closing, I would just say that this is a complicated area of the law, and this legislature has looked at it and courts have looked at it. It feels like we are at a settled place right now where good things are happening and progress is being made. I would be very concerned about unraveling any of that progress and would really urge caution. So thank you very much. Well,
Janet and Cheryl, I guess I would ask you, Mr. Cosgrove had indicated that this bill was in compliance or consistent with the Supreme Court decision that was made. I remember back when the bankruptcy changes were made. Do you view that way?
Chair Beyer, I don't feel that I can say that. This does not perfectly mirror NYDA and Brandrup. And so I have some real questions. To the extent it's trying to do that, it strikes me as a solution in search of a problem. We have a settled area. We've now taken an opinion with considerable guidance and deleted longstanding parts of the statute it was interpreting. That, as a lawyer, when you when you delete the very statute that's being interpreted by the court, I think you've lost the current state of the law.
I mean, I guess we have a conflict. I would hate to reverse all the work that we did a few sessions ago to try to address that. On the other hand, is there a way that we can address, I hear the bankers' concerns that we want to make sure that Oregonians can address the Fannie Mae and low-cost loans, and is there something there, is there a sort of a meeting of the minds where we can achieve both of those aims? If this doesn't do it, is there a way to get there?
And Chair Beyer, if I might, and members of the committee, there may be technical issues that are worthy of further consideration. I didn't hear anything that made it clear. Of course, community banks are fantastic members of the community, so I want them to continue practicing. It's my understanding that if a bank uses MERS as a way, you know, in the initiation of a loan, that loan then through the MERS system is able to be transferred and packaged and sold and resold. If the bank wants to foreclose, there's nothing that prohibits that bank from going through the judicial foreclosure process right now, today. And so if that's the case, then it doesn't seem to me that there's a problem. If that's not the case, then I need to further understand that.
Senator?
I think it's a question of costs. You know, these are small banks, and you're asking them to go through a court system that's really very, very expensive. So I come from rural Oregon, and so small banks are really important. So, and I understand the Supreme Court decision. So I'm trying to I'm trying to hear your side. I would agree with you, lines 8 through 11, using beneficiary to define beneficiary probably isn't the wisest use of words. But the rest of it, I'm trying to figure out what the argument is as far as who holds the paper, basically, and the need to foreclose. Now, some of these foreclosures, at least in committees that I've sat on before, meetings, are running 18 months. I'm sorry. That's just not, I mean, that's kind of nuts. And I don't think it's fair to the other people that have money in the banks or the banks themselves or to people that are taking out loans, because that goes into your loan rate. So what I want, I'm not speaking for the committee, but if you have concerns, I think their objections are valid. I would like to see where in this bill that you could actually make corrections and see if we could come back to some type of an agreement.
Senator Riley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So one of the things that I heard was that the lawsuits are being brought by a third party who's not part of the loan. And what I understood you to be saying, I think, when everybody was not understanding, is that that no one can do that anymore because they have to prove that they are part of the loan. Is that basically what we were saying?
Chair Beyer, Senator Riley, I'm not an expert on the Multnomah County lawsuits, but I believe the third party being referred to by Mr. Cosgrove were the counties. And so the counties aren't the borrower or the lender. So I think that was the third party being referred to, and the counties are saying you didn't. Well, I don't want to speak for the counties.
Follow up, please.
Please, go ahead.
So
I think that's a different issue.
Well, it's not really a different issue. It's part of what's being said is that they indicated that it was a lawyer who was going around and convincing the counties, apparently, to bring these lawsuits because they weren't getting their recording fees. And I think that's really at the heart of what their argument is. And it's a whole different argument than, I mean, these are two separate things, I think.
Senator, I think, and let me state, and please correct this if I'm wrong, I think there are two issues here. The issue you're addressing is the process that's used electronically of separating once the note is sold, the recording of who the owner is. It's really not the recording. It's just knowing who it is when you get to the point of foreclosing it.
But that's not
one issue. The other issue, which I think, and we'll let the county speak to this, is the counties say, you didn't record stuff, and so we missed out on some money, and we want our money.
Right.
Well, and
that's a different issue.
Chair Beyer, Senator Riley, members of the committee, I think they are related, though, because if you're trying to find a way in which that you can track the chain of ownership, and you want to make sure that that is reliable, and you want to make sure that it's publicly accessible and transparent, then having that reflected in a formal way through a county or other publicly accessible, a reliable process is very important. It turns out there are also fees to record. That's a different issue. But I think having the recordation of the transfers of ownership in some publicly available, reliable, transparent place is the critical issue from my perspective.
I was trying to remember back to, it's a long time, a few years ago when we talked about this, but what many of the courts were saying is you can't foreclose if you can't prove to us that you own the note.
Correct.
And the issue was that it was separated by the electronic system, which was trying, the servicer was trying to do it, and they had no record of title.
That's
the note in the court saying, we don't recognize you because you're not recorded as an owner.
And Chair Beyer,
part of the issue.
Yes, Chair Beyer and Senator Riley, members of the committee, I believe that is the heart of the issue. And I think without having it, those transfers recorded, it's very difficult to track them. And I think there's been litigation around the issue of how reliable and accessible are the MERS electronic records themselves. And I think the court was having sort of a concern about substituting those records for the records that are recorded in the county public process. One is much more reliable and transparent than the other. And if you're going to foreclose and allow an entity to foreclose, you want to make sure that you're letting the right entity foreclose and that they do, in fact, own the note.
Senator Riley?
So I get that. The question I have is, once that original loan is recorded, that title is, or that the mortgage is recorded, and then they sell it, who's responsible for recording the next transaction? And the one after that, and the one after that. Who's responsible for those recordings?
Chair Beyer, Senator Riley, I don't know the answer to that. It's possible that the counties would be able to speak to that.
Okay, I'll wait for them.
It could be out of state.
I know.
You have no way to do it.
Okay. More from this panel?
Really, I think the issue is who's responsible.
Thank you very much. Thank you
very much.
Let's see, Ellison McIntosh, maybe, and Emily Ryman.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Emily Ryman, and I'm the executive director of NEDCO, the Neighborhood Economic Development Corporation. We're a CDC that operates in Lane, Marion, and Clackamas counties, and we are, among other things, one of the largest foreclosure counseling agencies in the state of Oregon. I'm here today to speak in opposition of 968 because of what I see as the complete upheaval that it would cause to the mortgage servicing and our foreclosure prevention programs in the state. I entered the foreclosure arena in 2010 when I joined the staff at NEDCO. In 2010 and for probably 4 years after that, the foreclosure counseling arena was not a fun field to be in. The system was about as dysfunctional as I could possibly describe on every level. And we oftentimes worked with homeowners for 2 and 3 years at a time, and I would guess that we only got about 10 or 15% of those homeowners to any kind of an avoidance option. More often, we were a source of information and coaching, but we couldn't actually get them to an end result that was helpful. In the last 3 or 4 years, that field has done a 180-degree about-face, and the landscape is entirely different now. That is in part because of the Brandrup Supreme Court case that you heard mentioned earlier, and it's largely because of the foreclosure avoidance mediation program that the legislature implemented. Because of those two things, we finally have clarity in the field of mortgage servicing and the foreclosure process in the state of Oregon, and we have a transparent system for homeowners and for foreclosure counselors to work inside of. We now see about 70% of the cases that we work with, more than 70% of the cases we work with, get to a foreclosure avoidance option through the mediation program, which is incredible in my mind and actually more successful than I ever thought that program would be. The system upends that, the 968 upends that system in a couple of really key ways. One was mentioned earlier, and that is the provision that it would lift the prohibition on a lender from proceeding with a foreclosure even when a homeowner is complying with a foreclosure workout option. So a homeowner could have a modification, could be completing their trial modification period, and could suddenly lose the house to foreclosure even though they were 100% in compliance. I think that would be a terrible thing to introduce into the state of Oregon for our homeowners. The other thing that it does, which I know there's been some confusion about today, is basically create a new definition for who can be a beneficiary in this process. The reason that matters for me and the mediation program is that the mediation program requires certain steps of participation by the beneficiary. If an entity like MERS can be the beneficiary in these cases, it means a couple of things for mediation. One is that because MERS was not previously a beneficiary, I actually think they're going to fall under the exemption from the program that exempts beneficiaries who have not completed 100 foreclosures in the previous year. So all of the homeowners that have their mortgage assigned to MERS would not have access to the mediation program. And notes that are owned by banks that are currently required to participate, the big lenders, the ones that have all had the most problems items in their mortgage servicing would suddenly not have to participate in the program. The other kind of odd piece, even if they're not exempt, is that participating in the mediation program as the beneficiary, the homeowner would be in the rather curious position of negotiating a foreclosure avoidance measure with an electronic registry system that has no interest in the note, that has no ties, that doesn't own it, that isn't the servicer of it, and I'm not sure really what that would do or what that would mean. And I think it would bring the mediation and our ability to get any sort of workout option to a screeching halt in the state. As was mentioned previously, there are 500 or 600 homeowners a month currently being referred into that mediation program. It's still a problem in the state. It's especially a problem in the rural areas of the state, and it's important that we maintain a system that is stable and that has transparency and that works. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Thompson, members of the committee. My name is Allison McIntosh, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Housing Alliance to express our concern regarding and our opposition to Senate Bill 968. The Housing Alliance is a coalition of over 80 organizations from all parts of the state. We believe housing opportunity is the foundation on which all of our success is built. Individual success as students, parents, workers, community members, as well as the success of our communities. And we represent a diverse set of voices from residents to local jurisdictions, nonprofit housing developers, and service providers. Today, particularly in rural communities, the challenges created by the foreclosure crisis continue to linger. As Emily said, over 500 households every month are being referred to the foreclosure mediation program, and there are still about three times as many households who are 90-plus days delinquent on their mortgages as pre-foreclosure crisis. The foreclosure mediation program was created by the legislature, as you've heard, in 2012 and 2013 through Senate Bills 1552 and 558. The Housing Alliance strongly supports access to mediation and counseling for homeowners and has advocated both for the creation of those programs as well as for continued funding for counseling services. The mediation program, as you heard from Emily, is extremely successful, and we really believe preventing foreclosures is really key to stabilizing our communities. As all of you have seen, and we have seen the devastation caused by foreclosure and the lingering results of foreclosure, we're here to ask you to continue to protect homeowners. We have similar concerns that Emily expressed. First, homeowners and foreclosure counselors need to know who the real party interest in a mortgage loan is so that homeowners can negotiate with the right party. Under this bill, we believe mortgage loan lenders would no longer be required to record transfers, and homeowners need access to good information to be able to take the next step in a foreclosure or mediation process. Second, the foreclosure crisis really continues to linger in rural communities. Home values in rural parts of the state have not recovered quite as quickly, which gives homeowners fewer options. One of the things that we hear from some of our rural partners, particularly in Southern Oregon, is that the foreclosure crisis continues to be the main cause and driver of their housing crisis. As homeowners are foreclosed on or choose to walk away from their home, they're forced into an already crowded rental market and their homes sit vacant. Lastly, I would say the Oregon Foreclosure Avoidance Program and its mediation and counseling components have been extremely successful, and we need to continue to help homeowners access good information, particularly understanding who owns their loan. So with that, I would just close. As a state, we really believe we need to continue to protect families and individuals from the negative impacts of the foreclosure crisis and continue to maintain strong protections for homeowners. And we urge you to act with caution with regard to this bill. Thank you so much for your time today and for your service to our state.
Thank you. Questions? Seeing that, thank you very much. And let's see, I have two more people, Rob Buffet and Steve Dingle. Welcome, gentlemen.
Senator Byron, members of the committee, my name is Steve Dingle, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon County Councils Association and Lane County. I think I can address one of the concerns that have been raised. My written material talks about some of the other issues. It's not just recording fees, it's the damage to the grant or grantee indexes. And one of the unique problems that we've discovered is what I refer to as these zombie houses, which is a direct result of this system. Let me explain. Commissioner gets a call about a house that's in his district, It's in the process of foreclosure. It's been abandoned. It's got squatters. People are cooking drugs in it. It's doing all sorts of terrible things. Well, the first thing that they do is call the deputy sheriff out there, and what they want to do is trespass the people and arrest them for trespassing. You can't be here. So what does the deputy sheriff do? Deputy sheriff tries to figure out who is the responsible party, who can give authority to exclude these people from the house. So naturally, he goes to the assessor. The assessor tells him who's on the rolls. Then he goes to the clerk. And what it finds out is, and our assessor actually did this just to see if he could do it, and he spent 4 hours on the telephone being transferred, and ultimately ended up being referred to a company that described itself as a mortgage servicing company. And when he tried to, you know, he's trying to say, look, I need to know who the responsible party is. Would you like to make a payment today? How would you like to talk about restructuring your loan? He's like, no, I want to know who is responsible for this property. Who can send a letter to the sheriff to say that there is no one allowed to be at this house, and anyone there should be arrested for trespassing. So that's one of the collateral consequences of this system. And the same thing occurs with our code enforcement people. When these houses are abandoned, they became a safety hazard, the same exact situation. There is no one to contact. You know, typically what would happen is in a traditional mortgage, we would contact the lender, or the deputy sheriff would, or the code officer, and say, if you don't do this, this is what's going to happen, or if you want us to arrest people for trespassing, you'll need to give us a letter. So that's really the piece that I wanted to address. And I think the written material talks about the other issues that are associated with this. And again, the really tough part for local government is, who do the taxpayers get frustrated with? Who is ineffective? Who's incompetent? Who is damaging property? Who's putting people at risk? It's not the bank. It's the local government that's failing when they don't solve these problems. So that's really all I have, unless the committee has a question for me. I'll turn it over to Rob.
I have a question. The question I have is sort of what Senator Riley, I think, was hinting on, and that is, you know, they sell these loans. What happens when the loan is sold out of the state, and so on? So I understand the frustration with the system, but that's really not the bank's problem. And I don't understand how you can, I can understand your frustration, because I would be frustrated with that as well. But if the sale happened outside the state of Oregon, what can we do to make sure that that gets recorded?
Well, I think one of the systems, and I don't want to get into all the legalities, that opinion is 50-some pages long, but one of the significant differences, and I know that you expressed concern about judicial foreclosure, traditionally, if someone wanted to avail, if a lender wanted to avail themselves of that process, they had to record their interest in the county where the property was, which is what traditionally happened. So it was very easy to find out who owned the property. You went to the clerk's office and you looked up and saw who it was. To answer your question, the trade-off they make, and what I believe this bill does, is it allows them to use, they can continue to use MERS the way it is, but they have to go through judicial foreclosure. This bill would allow them to do non-judicial foreclosure for MERS thing. At least that's the way I read it. But in any event, that's it's not just the recording fees. I want the committee to understand this has real on-the-ground impact. And one of the frustrating things is that we're in Lane County, we're going through a housing crisis, finding affordable housing, and what happens? These lenders don't have any, because they're being passed around and sold, they don't have the interest of a traditional lender in the property. And in one of these instances that I'm talking about, the commissioner watched a perfectly good serviceable house that would have been an entry-level affordable house for someone. Over the course of 4 or 5 years, it became essentially whoever bought the property would burn the house down because it had been completely ruined and trashed over the years, which is in contrast to what happens typically when there's a local lender that, or a local person who has an interest in it. They're not going to let that happen.
What?
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, Rob Bovat, Legal Counsel, Association of Oregon Counties, here today representing the Oregon Association of County Clerks. As you know, the county clerks are the ones that operate and are the guardians of the very transparent public record that consists of real property transaction records, so we can know who has an interest in real property. Prior to the advent of the MERS system, this was not a problem. What the MERS system did was basically form a private corporation whereby banks could essentially assign various loans without any recording that's publicly available. This created all the sundry problems that you've heard about, some of which have been detailed here. The county clerks are opposed to this bill because what this would do is it would legalize the MERS system as essentially a non-public public record, and that's not acceptable. We need to be able to know who owns property and who has an interest in property. There is nothing about recording a Fannie Mae or a Freddie Mac loan or any loan in MERS that precludes anyone from getting an assignment of that loan from also recording it in the county deed records, which is the public record that everyone relies upon. This bill would undo that. This would allow essentially the MERS system to run as a private company, staining the public record, and should be rejected for that reason. Happy to answer any questions you might have.
Senator Hurley.
So I get all that, and I understand why we need to know who owns the property and who holds title and who has interest in the property. I don't know how they're already using the MERS system, so we're already past where you want to be, and I don't know how we get back there unless we know who's responsible and we can make them responsible for doing the recording. How do we do that?
Chair Beyer and Senator Riley, we are past that point, but this current status of the law that prior folks have testified is settled means that if a loan is essentially made, then the correct technical legal answer is to record that assignment in the property records today. That gives them their avenues of non-judicial foreclosure and judicial foreclosure. If they want to insist on continuing to use the MERS system and essentially not have the public record be complete, then they are limited to judicial foreclosure. That's the status of the law today, and that's the way it should remain, which is why you should not pass this bill.
So,
go ahead.
And I get all that. I understand exactly what you're saying. We do want these transfers recorded. How do we make that happen?
Well, Chair Byron, Senator Riley, I think we've done a couple of things already. One, the law requires them to do that right now. So they can choose not to do that, and then they've lost their non-judicial foreclosure option. So we've incentivized them to record their assignments in the record, which is what they should have been doing all along.
And this bill lets them do that and changes the law so they're not required to file. Is that what I'm hearing?
Mr. Chair, Senator Riley, in essence, that's what it would do. It would allow them to essentially assign and assign and assign endlessly all of these loans without transparency outside the public record, and they could still avail themselves of non-judicial remedies.
Mm-hmm. Isn't part of the issue, and maybe I'm wrong, but I'm drawing back on my memory, that what happened with a lot of these is once they were sold the first time, they were packaged together, bundled loans, and then those bundles would be sold, mm-hmm. and you never knew who owned what.
And Mr. Chair, if you
until
actually,
you get to a foreclosure or the abandoned situation you're talking about, and you and
Mr. Chair, I think those are all very well documented. The MERS system is probably one that's been written about in more law review articles than I can count. I have one-page simple, I think it's two-paragraph testimony on OLIS with a few links to a few of those key law review articles that exactly fully describe what you've just summarized. The MERS system created a whole host of problems that we can't certainly unwind, but we can keep the current incentives in place for lenders to record assignments of trust deeds and mortgages.
Mm-hmm. So I'm confused. I have been confused about one point. Mr. Cosgrove said that the Supreme Court decision had resolved that issue. And this bill, so I'm not sure what that means at the end
Chair,
of the day now.
Mr. Chair, I believe the Supreme Court decision did resolve that issue and basically said that MERS works to the extent that assignments can flow through MERS, but it does not allow for judicial foreclosure, or not does that for non-judicial foreclosure. So they're stuck basically with their judicial foreclosure remedy.
I think your legal colleague disagrees with you.
Well, and I guess Mr. Dingell can read from the opinion.
Yeah. If you just, I mean, the way I read it is, it was one of the questions that was certified from the federal court, and it's on page 702 of the opinion where it says they're talking about the two parts. It's talking about does MERS have the authority to act on their behalf with respect to non-judicial foreclosure, the non-judicial foreclosure process. For the reason now explained, the answer to the first part of the question is no. So that's the way that I read it. But really, it's just lack of clarity.
One last shot, and then I got to close this one down. Right. We've got a whole bunch of others sitting here.
Paul Cosgrove, Mr. Chair, thank you. Let me clarify. Before those Supreme Court decisions, all foreclosures in Oregon moved judicially because of the uncertainty with the courts. The comment just made is correct, but what happened is the court validated if MERS assigns it back out to a lender and the lender can prove the chain of title, even though there haven't been assignments, they can foreclose non-judicially. Non-judicial foreclosures is what's happening now. That incentive that if you don't record, you can't go non-judicially, that was resolved by the court. So the current status is MERS is required by Fannie and Freddie. It was actually set up by Fannie and Freddie and the title companies. MERS will not let you record assignments that you make Fannie and Freddie will not allow you to record assignments you make to Fannie and Freddie. They've refused. That's their guidance. We don't. At the end, if there is a foreclosure, of course, most of these loans don't go into foreclosure. So, but for the few that do, MERS assigns it back out to the lender, and the lender does a non-judicial foreclosure. That's the current
system. The originating lender?
And whoever owns the loan at that time per MERS's records. And as long as you can show that chain of title without recording, you can foreclose non-judicially. That's what the Supreme Court decided.
So then how do we preserve the arbitration system we set up?
The arbitration system is a system in which loan servicers are required to do the mediation. And there's nothing in this bill, there's no intent in this bill to affect, and it will not affect mediation. Because right now the mediation system is working in the system I just described, where there are assignments to MERS, or the loans are made with MERS as the nominee. There are assignments between lenders. If there's a default, it's assigned back out to a lender who owns the note and the trust deed. They start a foreclosure. Mediation occurs. There's somebody there. Everybody knows who that is. Mediation resolves the issue or doesn't. But the system has been working like this bill describes ever since those Supreme Court decisions. The difference this bill makes is it makes it clear that there's not going to be a legal penalty and a lawsuit and a litigation risk for not making those recordings.
Right. Oh,
that's what we're trying to do.
I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to close the public hearing. We've got some time to deal with this yet.
Thank you very much, Paul, ask
that you meet with the DOJ and others and see if you guys, you lawyers, can come to a common agreement that what's I think is important is we don't want to give up the system that protected consumers that we worked out in 15 or whenever it was. At the same time, we would like to be able to have community banks to be able to use the federal programs. So I don't know if there's a coming together or not, but why don't you see what you can do. Okay, we're going to close on that. And I wait, before I do that, is there anybody else who felt a need to discuss this?
Yeah,
that didn't sign up? Don't see any? Okay, we'll stay closed. And I want to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 774. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 774 prohibits insurers from imposing a fee surcharge, premium increase, or other charge on the basis of certain aspects of the customer's claims history. Prohibits insurers and insurance producers from determining a rate or imposing a fee surcharge, premium increase, increase or other charge on homeowner insurance policy on the basis of certain consumer inquiries. The measure has an emergency clause that would take effect upon passage. It has no fiscal or revenue impact and no amendments, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Stephen.
National banking policies.
I believe I introduced this for you. If I could have your name, put your name on the record, please, and then.
My name is Stephen Kale.
Everything has to be judiciary.
Chair Beyer. I'm appearing today in support of this measure, Senate Bill 774, and I thank you for the opportunity to voice my views. I'm of the opinion that the insurance industry has seized a loophole in the law that enables them to penalize policyholders unjustifiably. Point of fact, if I am responsible for the liability of damage for an insurance claim, then I am certainly at a higher risk, and I should be charged higher rates for insurance. No argument there. But if a claim is made against an insurance policy for no fault damages, then a policyholder should not be further penalized by having their rates increased or a surcharge applied to them. There must be hundreds of instances that fit this scenario. I personally had the misfortune of bad weather at my property during 2 of 3 straight years. Extraordinarily heavy snow weight 1 year that collapsed my carport, and snow followed by high winds during the 3rd year. The damage was significant enough that I chose to actually use the policy that I'd paid for and filed damage claims. The result, surprisingly, was that a significant surcharge was applied to my premiums for damages that were clearly no fault, weather. My view is that everyone in this room will fall into the scenario eventually. Things happen. If your turn hasn't arrived yet, it soon will. When I first inquired about the legality of charging for no-fault claims in February of last year, I was told by the Department of Consumer and Business Services that, quote, there is nothing in the insurance code that prohibits an insurance company from increasing premiums due to claims, whether the claims are within the control of the policyholder or not. In other words, it's legal simply because it's not illegal. Logically, the 30 prior years that I had with no claims whatsoever should count in my favor. They did not. I had the misfortune of having 2 acts of God affect my insurance rates for a period of 5 years. 5 years was apparently enough time for my insurance company to recover the money that they had paid me for damages to my property. Again, if I'm at fault, charge me more. I'm a higher risk. The practice of increasing premiums or applying for a surcharge for no-fault claims should be illegal.
Questions, Mr. Kemp? I don't see any. Thank you very much.
I might add, if I could, sure. I had an additional comment to make. I come from a rather unique position, coincidentally, with regard to this particular bill. I spent 20 years as a social science researcher with the Lewis Harris Company and other prominent research firms. That unique background, coincidentally, kind of dovetails with my personal experience in that many of the research projects that I worked on were insurance company related by complete coincidence. I also had research projects that dealt with political issues, that dealt with education and various things, literally hundreds of different research projects. One in particular, I interviewed the CEO of a major insurance company in Portland. This was several years ago, and I had to go back and basically search my memory to remind me of what this gentleman told. Now, he did enjoy his $200 bribe, in order to get to gain access to his office so that Lewis Harris could ask him some questions. But he was telling me some things during this particular interview that were more or less off the record. They didn't become part of the interview. It was basically a formal survey. And a few of his comments might be very interesting to you. Now, these are paraphrasing from my memory. We have a staff that examines law's details to see how we can gain an advantage. What business doesn't do that? I can understand that. Our main responsibility is to our shareholders, not our policyholders. And of interesting, our industry, the insurance industry, is unique. We don't manufacture anything. We don't need a warehouse to store items to sell. We don't need a typical retail store where customers come in droves to buy our product. We sell a contract, an idea, one that can be stuffed into a simple envelope and mailed at a very low cost. Ours is one of the highest profit margin industries in the world, and we aim to keep it that way.
I think so. Thank you very much,
Thank
sir.
Thank you, sir.
Appreciate you coming. Let's see. I have two other people signed up, John Powell and Lana Butterfield.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Powell. Before you, representing State Farm Insurance Companies. Mr. Chairman, and I might add that's State Farm Mutual, which is owned by its policyholders and not stockholders. There are no stockholders. Let me begin by simply saying that the previous witness talked about fault and no fault. The bill itself does not differentiate in that regard. And it sometimes, in a case of weather-related issues, the question of fault, particularly in back-to-back claims, can deal with how something is reconstructed and whether or not it's reconstructed properly. And so that can be a challenge to determine at what point a claim like that could be a fault or not. But existing law in Oregon says an insurer cannot consider claims more than 5 years old for underwriting and rating purposes. So if a claim happened more than 5 years ago, you cannot use it. In addition, you cannot use the first claim in the last 5 years. So that's another notch that you can't use. And if this bill passes, then you can't use any claims in the 5 years prior to renewal, which means you can't use claims basis for rating or underwriting. And we would oppose that. The data on losses does indicate that people that have more frequent losses have future losses, and that's just clear in the data. And those people paying into an insurance pool should pay more because their risk is more. And after 5 years, if or 3 years even in some companies, if you have no claims, then any surcharge that might have been put on a policy for claims activity is taken off. In fact, insurance companies have been fighting in this building for several years on the use of different mechanisms to establish rates and underwriting. And the reason we're always given is you should just use claims basis for underwriting. And this bill would say you can't use that. So we oppose it on that basis, Mr. Chairman, and be glad to answer any questions.
Lana?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lana Butterfield, and I'm here on behalf of the Professional Insurance Agents of Oregon. We, too, are opposed, and you have my testimony on OLIS, if you care to read that. I also put on OLIS for you the Homeowner's Bill of Rights, which sets out the homeowner's reasons for having rights in the insurance policy, and that was passed about 5 years ago, I think. Essentially, the proposed legislation would require insurers to reward high risk of loss policyholders with artificially reduced premiums and punish low risk of loss policyholders with increased premiums necessary to subsidize the high risk folks. So I don't know. I can't speak to the case that was brought before you, but I can speak to the bill, and we are opposed to the bill. Thank you.
Questions? Don't see any. Thank you very much. Is there anybody else who wishes to address this bill? Seeing none, we will close on Senate Bill 774. And which are the ones we can get out of the way here, Patrick? Let's trying to clean the agenda here a little bit. Do the easy stuff.
They're all essentially the same length.
They're all the same? Well, that didn't help.
So far you've failed. Admitting the easy stuff.
I haven't done well today. Okay, so we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 978. Patrick.
Senate Bill 978 prohibits the electric companies from including in its rates the cost of electric generation resources, energy storage resources capable of generating electricity or storing electricity for not less than 5 years, et cetera, et cetera. I could go on, but I would defer to Mr. Gardner and his associate to speak to the Dash 2 amendment, which replaces the original measure, Mr. Chair. With the Dash 2, the Dash 2 comes with a fiscal statement indicating a need to refer to Ways and Means and also a statement of no revenue impact, Mr. Chair.
Good enough.
Jim, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, and I'm appearing today for NIPSE, the Northwest and Intermountain Power Producers Coalition. And as Mr. Brennan indicated, we're going to be talking today solely about the Dash 2 Amendment, which basically converts the bill into a study bill. There is draw your attention to the last line of it, of the fiscal, which says the proposed new position that's at the PUC will be funded by existing resources through the PUC's gross operating fee, so we wouldn't need a new fee or a new other fund increase in terms of the fee. It's simply using that existing fee. With that, I'd like to turn it over to NIPSE's legal counsel to describe the content of the study bill, Mr. Sanger.
Thank you, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. NIPSE is a trade association whose members are active participants in the wholesale and retail.
I need you to put your name on the record, please.
Oh, sorry. Irene Sanger, here on behalf of NIPSE, the Northwest and Intermountain Power Producers Coalition. So just as groundwork, NIPSE is a trade association whose members participate in electricity markets in the Pacific Northwest and Western markets. NIPSE's role is to represent independent power producers and electricity service suppliers in developing rules, policies, and laws that foster the healthy development of wholesale markets in the Pacific Northwest. As Mr. Gardner mentioned, Senate Bill 978 has recently been amended with a Dash 2 amendment for a study bill which would direct the Oregon Public Utility Commission to evaluate whether the centuries-old regulatory compact that underlies investor-owned utilities service to ratepayers is still an appropriate regulatory model. We believe that now is the time to investigate this fundamental question, which is what functions do we want regulated monopolies to perform in the modern world? Now, there have been significant changes in law and policy that we believe warrant revisiting the current utility business model to ensure that generation resources that are acquired are the least cost and least risk options for consumers. Now, this review needs to occur promptly because the utilities are planning on acquiring enormous amounts of new generation in the next few years. As a preliminary, I want to go over what the utility business model, what the current regulatory approach is, because utility matters are complex, maybe not quite as complex as what we heard earlier, but they are something that not everybody's familiar with. The electric utility business model is a de facto regulatory agreement, a regulatory compact, by which investor-owned utilities are provided an opportunity to recover their prudently incurred costs plus a rate of return or profit on their investments. So, and in exchange, The Public Utility Commission is an economic regulator that makes sure that the rates are adequate, fair, just, and reasonable. So that's this compact. Now, this regulatory compact provides an economic incentive to the utilities to invest, build, and own transmission, distribution, and generation facilities. In the early part of the 20th century, that was a good thing, which built up our electric utility system, which allowed electricity to be provided and electrify the nation. So the utilities had an incentive to build and own and build and own generation resources. The question now is that the world has changed over the last few decades, and the PUC should study whether this approach still makes sense, whether it's still in the customer's best interest for the utilities to have an incentive to own and operate generation resources. Since the 1970s, there's been significant changes in regulatory policies that have created what we call the independent power producer. So this is a non-utility owner of generation resources that sells power directly to the utility or to the end-use consumer. These IPPs put their own capital at risk. They put their own resources at risk rather than ratepayer money, which can result in the development of more economic, less risky, and lower cost generation resources. Now, we have numerous examples from the Trojan Nuclear Power Plant to PGE's recently constructed Cardi gas-fired generation plant, which call into question this basic regulatory compact, where PGE's Cardi facility is $150 million over budget, over what PGE said it was going to cost. PGE is suing the insurers, but if it's not able to recover these costs from the insurers, then it's going to come and ask for these costs to be recovered from ratepayers. Wall Street will demand that they seek these costs back from ratepayers. So in our view, this would never happen if an IPP was the owner of that resource, because they would have put their own capital at risk. And if they had failed, then ratepayers would not be on the hook. Utility investments going forward are going to be more risky. There's more new technologies that are improving energy efficiency, developing distribution, demand response resources, distributed generation. These things call into question aspects of the utility business model. Changes in Oregon regulatory policy, from the coal to clean bill, the increase in the renewable portfolio standard, the potential for a carbon tax or a cap and trade program, all of these things make utility investments more risky and suggest that IOUs, investor-owned utilities, should not be making all the investments in new generation resources. And there's been numerous ambitious changes in Oregon regulatory policy over the last few years. None of these, however, have looked at the fundamental business model of why utilities are making investments and what economic incentives they have that drives their decision-making. This bill would direct the PUC to conduct a comprehensive study of that business model to see if the incentives that are there should continue to exist on a going forward basis. The last thing that I want to go over is, why are we doing this now? Why is it important to do this study at this time? And over the past 10 years, the Public Utility Commission has required utilities to mitigate this bias, to address this bias through competitive bidding process. Chairman Beyer was at the PUC when this process was developed. It was a revolutionary idea that had a lot of merit and benefit. However, over the last 10 years, 95% of the electric capacity in this competitive bidding process has been utility owned, even when the resource was not the least cost, least risk resource for consumers. So our view is that we need to reevaluate this now. PGE is planning on building 175 megawatts of renewable resources around 2018, 850 megawatts of capacity resources, gas-fired generation in 2021, and PacifiCorp just this week announced that it's going to build or own over 1,000 megawatts of new wind generation resources. We believe that before these decisions are made, before the proverbial horse leaves the barn, we should take a reevaluation, a reanalysis of this utility business model and see if what we're doing makes sense so that ratepayers don't pay for more expensive and riskier generation resources. Thank you.
Questions? I will note that I think that, and have been saying for a long time, that we probably need to revisit the rate-making structure. I think that, frankly, that's a national discussion. You guys know that. There is something we need to keep in mind, though, from a public policy. This kind of decision works can potentially work well for large industrial customers, or large commercial, for that matter, too. But we have to be careful from a public policy perspective that we don't leave the bulk of the small customers out there at higher risk. It's always been a balancing thing. But it's worth taking a look at. I think I agree with that. Any other questions, comments? Thank you. Okay.
Thank you.
Let's give the utilities a shot here. Varner, Seaman, Brett, and Sean Miller. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I'm here today on behalf of PacifiCorp, an electric utility that operates in Oregon as Pacific Power, serving about 570,000 customers in the state. And on OLIS, you should have it should be posted a letter from Scott Bolton regarding our opposition to Senate Bill 978, as well as the Dash 2 amendments. And we've just recently had a chance to look through the Dash 2 amendments. And although it's called a study bill, I think it is designed for a predetermined outcome of some of the issues that are outlined in Mr. Bolton's letter. And again, you know, they're trying to accomplish, obviously, is why whether or not an electric company should be prohibited from including in the rates the cost of of major generation resources moving into the future. And when you look at the Dash 2 amendment, again, it's very prescriptive. It also, if you look on page 2, lines 21, it also wants to evaluate the mission of the Public Utility Commission. And so there's several things in there that are very prescriptive and, again, I think flies in the face of the direction that we're moving forward in this industry. And so, you know, again, we would oppose the bill. The Public Utility Commission has an open process. We believe it's fair, a fair process. And we think that a study like this kind of weakens that process moving forward. And again, I think a lot of this can be done in those discussions at the Public Utility Commission right now, Mr. Chair, and that concludes my testimony.
Thank you, Sean. I just note that we don't have Sean R. Scott's testimony.
It's going up right now.
So.
Okay.
It's missing.
No problem. I submitted a while back, but it will be on very soon.
Let me ask you a question. Is the opposition to this proposed study or a study in general done by the PUC?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think the PUC can study these issues now, and so I think there's no need for legislation. I think if we want to have a discussion and have that discussion at the Public Utility Commission, we're more than happy to have that discussion. I don't think we need a bill for that.
And the other utility.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Varner Seaman, representing the other utility, Portland General Electric, although that's not how we like to think of ourselves, but appreciate the friendly comments.
So should I say another utility?
Sure. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, that works too. I'm here today testifying in opposition to 978 as well as the Dash 2 amendment, and appreciate the opportunity. As we looked, and again, we just had chance to look at the Dash 2 a moment ago, and I think to your question, Senator Beyer, I don't think we have a problem with the PUC taking up the questions about the utility business model. As you indicated, this is a national conversation which is taking place in a lot of different places, going in a lot of different directions. What we would note is that we've got some concern with the language in the Dash 2 that it looks like it points in the direction of a predetermined outcome around this. Although the chair, I'm sure, is aware of this, just for the benefit of the other members of the committee, the current mission of the PUC is around the direction of adequate availability, reliability, affordability for customers in the state. The folks that NPSC represents are some multinational companies, some large banks that play in the energy trading space. I mean, frankly, when we look at the NPSC membership list, PGE is a relatively small company compared to the folks that they represent. We would want to make sure that the regulatory construct for the Public Utility Commission is to protect customers in the state, not for the benefit of multinational companies that would like to have the opportunity to do business. So we want to make sure that if there were a study going forward, that we have the right policy direction that we're looking for, which is how do you keep rates affordable, how do you mitigate for risk. One of the things just briefly that was talked about was the CARDI experience that we've had recently. We did bring on a power plant, was that last year, the CARDI power plant, which is operating very well up in the Boardman area. That plant was built by an independent power producer. It's not a NPSC member, but still an independent power producer, a company called Abacena, which is a subsidiary of Abengoa, which is a company that went bankrupt during the construction. We disagree with the assertion. Now, we had a contract with them. They were going to build the plant. And we were going to take over ownership at the point that the plant was constructed, which has happened. Their bankruptcy caused some significant cost overruns. We are going to collect from insurers around that. I'm not sure that having a power purchase agreement versus a build by transfer would necessarily entirely mitigate risk for our customers. There's a question if somebody's building a plant for us and we need that power on a date certain and they go bankrupt and they don't build that plant, we have to go to the market. We've got to go figure out how to get that plant out of bankruptcy. We don't see, and I think that the CARDI example actually kind of works the other example, which was we had an independent power producer that was trying to build a plant for us. They went bankrupt, and it caused some disruption for us. We have insurance. We think that we're going to get recovery that way. We actually think that case points in a opposite example. So I think that we don't think that 978, the underlying bill, was a great bill. We don't think turning a bad bill into a study bill makes it a better bill. We don't have a problem with the PUC taking a look at these issues writ large. We want to make sure that the scope is appropriate, that we're taking the right comprehensive approach if we're going to be changing the mission of the PUC in a pretty substantial way.
Mr. Sims.
Chair Beyer, committee members, my name is Brett Sims. I'm responsible for resource planning and procurement for PGE. I want to comment on, I think, a couple of underlying assumptions behind 978, as well as the bill to move forward a study. And that is, first of all, there appears to be an incorrect assumption, we believe, that there utility power supply portfolios are lacking in the diversity of ownership. We don't believe that's the case. It certainly isn't the case for PG's portfolio. Today, we have 95 contracts for power supply from other providers, not PGE. Those contracts total over 1,600 megawatts of supply in terms of generating capability, and they represent a wide diversity of sellers, from very large international and national independent power producers and power marketers to local and regional developers to municipalities and other utilities. Now, I will admit, some of those entities, and in fact, maybe many of those entities, are not NPSC members. But that doesn't make those contracts not contracts from other parties other than the utility.
They also represent an extremely wide diversity of technologies: wind, solar, biomass, biogas, natural gas, geothermal, solid municipal waste. I mean, virtually every generating technology that's out there is represented in our power contracts, and they also traverse a very wide range of sizes, from very small contracts of 1 to 2 megawatts to large contracts of a few hundred megawatts. The second issue I want to address that seems to be a key assumption behind the proposed legislation in the study is that there's a lack of an ability for competitive providers to compete for and to sell to utilities to serve our electric supply. We don't believe that's the case. The commission has in place rules and guidelines to ensure that any time a utility seeks a new source of power supply, that all resources, both contracts and utility-owned options, are fairly considered and appropriately selected. Those guidelines have been updated as recently as 2014. And in fact, to my knowledge, the most recent version of the competitive bidding guidelines haven't even been applied to a utility RFP. We certainly haven't had one since then, and I don't believe PacifiCorp has either. And in fact, the commission currently has open a brand new docket to consider further improvements to the competitive bidding process. So again, based on, you know, sort of those underlying fundamental assumptions, which we believe to be flawed and incorrect, we don't believe that there's merit to either 978 or to the amendment to move forward with a study on those same provisions.
Questions? Brett, I guess I have one for you. The Utilities Trade Association nationally has been advocating for changing the rate-making structure, saying the design won't work into the future. Do you disagree with that?
I completely agree that the world is changing in terms of the energy marketplace, in terms of how the grid's likely to operate, the types of resources that would be deployed in the future. And as a result, I think it's probably worth looking at changes to the rate making and regulatory structure. I don't think we can have a new electric grid in an old system of regulation. I don't think those things will be compatible. Now, what it would look like and what would be appropriate, I don't know. What I do believe is that I think customers should have all choices available to them, including cost of service and market. I don't think limiting choices to either one is in the customer's interest.
Hard to do under the current rate-making paradigm. Okay. Anybody else? Don't want to hog this. It's sort of one of my issues. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Is there anybody else who wishes to address this bill? Seeing none, Mr. Eisdorfer. And what does the PUC think?
Chair, members of the committee, Jason Eisdorfer, Program Director of the Public Utility Commission. The commission takes no position on the bill. However, because this is the dash two I'm speaking of, because that study bill goes to the core mission of the Public Utility Commission and who, what, and how to regulate, I think it would be negligent of us not to have at least some observations. And I have five very quick ones. The first one is I agree with the thrust of the study bill, and frankly I agree with the utilities that were just up here in recognizing that there are significant amounts of changes in the electricity sector, and it is entirely appropriate for the commission to take stock of those various regulatory approaches. However, I guess there's 4 points I would make with regard to the bill itself. First, my staff is already considering a different venue for basically this very investigation in conjunction with a docket that was mentioned earlier on competitive guidelines. In about a week or two, the staff will present a memo to the commission in which the staff is going to define the problem statement that I think we're struggling with here. That would further justify exploration of these larger regulatory concepts and also recognize the significant energy and interest from stakeholders who want to have that conversation. So staff is going to inform the commission that it intends to identify the drivers and policies that and what those implications may be. So we're frankly already on this path, and we've been on this path internally for about 8 weeks. It's just a matter of the timing. So that will come out shortly, and I'm glad to hear that the utilities will welcome this conversation as we go forward. However, I think that the language in this bill is really mostly focused on one set of those problems, and that pertains to the incumbent utility and rate basing of capital investment. There are a number of issues that are implicated here. New environmental policies, the impact of distributed generation, and the role of the utility in terms of distribution system planning, increased customer sophistication and choices, new transmission markets, and so all of these really deserve exploration on equal footing. I think the commission would like to give all of those points fair hearing in the investigation. The bill contemplates a report to the legislature, and while those reports are valuable to us and to you, I think the staff's vision would actually begin having the conversation, not just to make a report to the commission, but to identify where there is areas of agreement, where there's areas where the commission can start moving forward without legislation, but clearly to the degree possible get as much buy-in from stakeholders to come back to you for legislative guidance if we need that. And then finally, the bill calls for a report in 2018. So I have to admit to you that the issues in this bill are nothing less than existential. The reason there's a fiscal on this is because if we were to do this on top of what we are doing right now, this is so fundamental and so important that we would need some additional help, essentially. And the reason for that primarily is because on top of what we would normally be doing during this time, 2017 is very much the implementation year for Senate Bill 1547. We have, I didn't count them, I should have, we have something like 7 or 8 different dockets that are open to implement that bill. Trying to do both at the same time is going to be a little bit of a challenge. And in fact, running through some of those dockets on 1547 may actually help inform us about the bigger picture opportunities and challenges. So that's all a detailed way of saying staff believes that we need to start looking at this, and we are going to start having a conversation with the commission via this public meeting memo. And at the appropriate time, and frankly, it's probably not in the next 3 or 4 months, but probably toward the end of the year, I think staff will have done the homework, done the groundwork, identified the problem statement with the challenges, and make a recommendation to the commission to start up a more formal process with all the stakeholders involved.
Senator.
So what I understand is that right now you're looking at scope and trying to figure out what all it is you need to really look at to address the 21st century model that maybe we need to have, and it'll be 6 months or so before you've even identified the scope, and at that time you can probably tell us when you would be done with this.
Mr. Chair, Senator Riley, when done is it? I would agree with almost everything you said. When done is maybe a little tougher. New York went on did this same kind of thing, and it's taken them three something years to get to certain points. But yes, generally what you're saying is as we're doing all the other work and implementing 1547, we will begin constructing. What I generally tell my staff is tell me what the problem is first that we're trying to solve. And that's what I think we need to do is to do a good job of identifying the problem statement. There are various forms of it out there. It's not inventing it's not rocket science to figure out what's happening, but I do think it is critical for the commission to understand what scope, what are the kinds of issues that we can really address and take care of? What are the kinds of issues that we need legislative guidance on? So so basically, you're correct. It's scoping the problems and the challenges, identifying the policy dynamics that are changing. And once we identify that, we do what we do really well, which is bring our stakeholders together and run through some process. This is going to be highly contentious, and it works better if we sit down together. And I would say it's going to be highly contentious, but the as the chair knows, in the electricity world, we do a lot by agreement, and it just takes a little bit of time to get there. And so what I would say is let a preferred approach, obviously, for us, and it's ultimately your decision, is to let us identify what the problem statement is, give us a shot with our stakeholders, and frankly, if that's not working and we're not making progress, certainly we'll take all the direction you can give us.
So, follow up. So if I'm following you, maybe by next February the 1st, you might have something to tell us.
Mr. Chair, Senator Riley, if you want us to come back and to report to you where we are, we would be happy to do that.
Well, you were correct in one point, particularly. It is our decision to make.
Yes.
Yeah. And I do appreciate the work you're doing, but I do think two things. On Mr. Sager's point that there is a lot that's going to happen based on the legislation in the next 18 months, I would say, to 3 years. And so I do think there is a little bit of urgency to get started and talk about this. I think where I would like to end up is giving you a little mandate to kick it in the rear a little bit, and ask that perhaps you go off and think about this a little bit and come back in the next few days with a recommendation on what the study framework might look like. I'd like to see, I think it makes some sense to have a report back, maybe not the whole thing done by September of 18. I do think that makes some sense in case you do need some legislation. My experience and my frustration with the commission, including the 10 years I was there, is it took a long time to get things done. Often, you know, when I was getting pressure to get orders out, it still took a long time. And a lot of that was not the PUC staff. It was the people who participated and thought we had to move quicker, but demanded more time to think about it. So sometimes a little direction helps. So I guess I would ask you, Jason, to think about that, and I would like to see if you think there's some amendment to this language. I think you have a lot of help out there and people thinking what it might be, but I'd like to see your cut at it. And the commission from
Chair Byron,
I'd rather the commission telling me what they think they can get done, recognizing we want to move in this direction, knowing that we may not be able to resolve it all, or need to. But
Chair Byron, we can do that.
Thank you very much. Anything else? Seeing none, is there anybody else? Thank you very much, Jason. I appreciate you. Anybody else want to talk about this one? We'll close this one. And let's see, what else can we get to here? We're just going to open on Senate Bill 97. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 97 is brought to us by DCBS. I will just dispense and say that there's a Dash 2 amendment, which I believe Mr. Blackmill is going to come tell us about. And I can tell you that with the Dash 2 amendment, which is the version that's going that they would prefer to go forward, the bill has no fiscal or revenue impact, Mr. Chair.
Quicker the better.
Absolutely. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rick Blackwell, policy manager for the Division of Financial Regulation within Department of Consumer and Business Services. I've already burned up a minute there. Thank you for considering Senate Bill 97. So this might seem like a bill that only a regulator could love, frankly, but the idea is that we are, as we go through events, we try to make sure that the laws have been fine-tuned to reflect some our experiences in making sure insurance companies are well-managed and able to pay their claims. And so following some events in 2016 with some of our insurance companies, we identified some areas where we'd like to make some changes that would help us get to that point to make sure the insurance companies are well run. And so the Dash 2 amendments actually are a result of work that we did with stakeholders to make sure that the bills comport with NAIC model laws. So these are the model laws that states typically adopt. They're drafted and well vetted through the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. In particular, we're just very mindful to make sure that those models, the state law comports substantively with those models, because companies that cross, that operate in multiple states need to have that kind of certainty. So with me is Greg Lathrop. He's the Insurance Institutions Manager. He can answer any questions, technical questions you might have. But essentially, the issues that we're trying to address with the bill are ensuring that we can assess costs for for supervisory events where a company's not in receivership but is being supervised by the department. It's an expensive endeavor to be actively involved in the affairs of insurance company. We found a potential issue where a healthcare service contractor, which is actually a certain type of insurance carrier, could possibly avail themselves of bankruptcy laws, and so we wouldn't be able to actually place them under supervision to protect Oregon consumers, that Oregonians that have insurance policies through them. We're looking for some flexibility on timelines. Typically, you know, there's a lot of federal and state timelines that have to be met in terms of policy renewal and so forth, at the same time that we're having a rather extraordinary event occur. And so we'd like to be able to suspend or reduce those timelines as appropriate in order to make sure that we can orderly supervise a company that needs the supervision. We want to make sure that the boards have a little diversity. Boards are an important check on corporate, they're an important source of direction for the corporation. Right now, boards, we'd like to clarify that the boards of directors for a service contractor have at least two members of the public who are not either practicing, or let's see, we want to include members of the public who are not practicing physicians or employees or trustees of a hospital. So just getting more diversity on the board of directors. We actually found a requirement that required bricks and mortar record storage in the state. Kind of a strange anachronism in the era of cloud storage, so we propose to modernize that. With that, that's a very brief summary of the bill before you. We're going to continue to work with stakeholders as necessary to make sure that that what gets passed comports with these NAIC models, and for us to be able to use NAIC regulations in structuring any rules that are needed to implement these changes.
So let me just ask a quick question.
Yes, sir.
Maybe I can shorten this a little bit.
Yeah.
We have on file, in the file here, a letter from NAMIC, is that how you say it? The National Association of Mutual Insurance Companies. It
says that's correct.
This is essentially model national legislation that the industry is proposing, that they have assisted you in adopting so it fits into Oregon statutes. Is that
Chair Beyer, that's correct. We are proposing to adopt one model and incorporate changes, updates for another model.
So I take it that it's supported. Since it's an industry model, it's supported by the industry.
Chair Beyer, these models are very well vetted at a national level. That's correct.
Got questions, folks? Do you need more?
No, I'm good.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there anybody else who would like to testify on Senate Bill 97? Seeing none, we will close public hearing, open work session. Chair moves Senate Bill 97 to the floor, but they do pass.
You need the Dash 2s.
Excuse me. Let me back up. The Chair moves the Dash 2 amendments. Thank you. Discussion on the motion. Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, Dash 2s are adopted. Now the Chair moves Senate Bill 97 as amended by the Dash 2s to the floor with the do pass recommendation. Discussion. Seeing none, it is adopted. And anybody you want to try and carry it? I'll do it.
You can explain.
I got it. We'll close on that. We will open on Senate Bill 98. Public hearing.
Yes, sir. So, Senate Bill 98, also DCBS, Mr. Chair. This measure deals with residential mortgage loans. We have a Dash 4 amendment, which makes several technical changes to the bill. I'll let DCBS explain that as well. With the Dash 4 amendment, the measure has a fiscal impact, which is in your packets and on OLIS, and a minimal revenue impact. The LFO has requested this bill go to Ways and Means, and I believe DCBS is aware of that and can speak to that as well, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Please. Chair, again, for the record, I'm Rick Blackwell, policy manager with DFR, then DCBS. With me is Alex Chang, senior policy analyst who's been working on the bill. As quickly as I can, this bill may have some deja vu for you, as this bill was considered in 2015 by Senate Bill 275. Just for really quick background, mortgage loan servicers are handling the critical administrative functions of the payback process, essentially, once the loan has been funded by a creditor. Historically, this is a bank and credit union issue, but as requirements for capital have increased nationally and entities have essentially been selling tranches of loans to these third-party servicers for which we're not able to be accountable to Oregonians because there's no licensing nexus in the state. After 275 didn't move through the legislature, we rolled up our sleeves. Worked with stakeholders in the interim to try to reach a consensus and on how to approach the issue, which is really what the Dash 4 is. This is still an issue. We've received almost 950 complaints in the last 5 years on servicing, which is about 82% of all we get. It's also pretty consistent with the national issues with servicers. This bill would allow us to join 33 other states in regulating loan servicers and to be accountable to Oregonians when they have questions or problems with their loan servicer. And with that, I'm going to turn it over really briefly to Alex Chang to talk about the Dash 4 amendment.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Alex Chang. I'm a senior policy analyst with the Division of Financial Regulation. Very quickly, I just wanted to note that this bill with the Dash 4 amendment is the work product of a working group that we had convened over the last year, consisting of stakeholders representing consumer advocates, foreclosure counselors, mortgage lenders, servicers, and others, to craft a regulatory framework that focuses in on the entities that are the greatest source of consumer harm here in Oregon, namely non-bank servicers that are in the business of purchasing servicing rights from lenders who originated the loan. Adopting this measure would level the playing field for the already regulated banks, credit unions, and other lenders, and this would make non-bank servicers accountable to the state of Oregon. So with that, I'll urge the committee support for the bill, and thank you for your time, and we'll answer any questions.
Okay. Any questions? Seeing that.
Chair
Beyer, Senator Monroe, the Dash 4 amendment would require non-bank servicers to obtain a license from DCBS. It would set minimum standards for collecting payments, applying loan payments, managing escrow accounts. It would give DCBS examination powers and powers to investigate consumer complaints that we receive.
Chair Beyer and Senator Monroe, the Dash 4 really is a culminate. We had to introduce this very early on, so we worked with stakeholders to make sure that all of those provisions worked, and that's really what the Dash 4s represent.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
Since you're assuming more duties, how does this not have a financial or a fiscal?
Chair Beyer and Senator Drodd, well, it actually does have a fiscal that's built into the governor's recommended budget.
Oh, so does this go to Ways and Means?
Goes to Ways and Means, yeah. Any other questions? Seeing none. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Cosgrove?
Mr. Chair, Paul Cosgrove representing Oregon Financial Services Association, the Association of State-Licensed Consumer Finance Companies that make mortgage loans and other loans. We appreciate the division working with us to clarify some of the exemptions from this bill so we don't have entities having to have dual licenses, and that was our concern. The Dash 4 covers that concern. Thank you very much. We have no further concerns about the bill. Thank you.
Question? Go ahead.
Yeah, I have concerns about the bill, and that is it just seems like it's broadening the scope of people that require. Am I just misreading the bill, or does it require more licensure from DCBS?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rod, might be a better question or a question in which DCBS might have a different answer. Yes, it includes people who are not licensed by Oregon in a new license category as mortgage servicers. Our concern was not to have dual licenses of people already licensed, and that's been addressed in the Dash 4.
Okay.
Chair Beyer, if I may approach. Senator Drudd, we worked really hard with stakeholders to make sure that we focused on the folks that were had no nexus with us at this at the state right now. And so I think with the Dash 4, that really clarified who was who the folks that we were looking at as the source of the license. To, yeah.
Okay.
Well, let's just I'm confused a little bit, but it's more? Late in the day.
Huh? It's late in the day. Okay. Thank you. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 98? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing. We'll open the work session. Chair moves the Dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 98.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. Dash 4s are adopted. Chair moves Senate Bill 98 as amended by the Dash 4s with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Discussion.
I'm not comfortable with the due pass.
Well, would you like to vote no?
I would enjoy that.
Huh?
I would enjoy that.
You've been waiting all season to do that.
Yeah.
Any other no's? We'll find out.
No, I'm good.
You're good? Okay, so Senate Bill 98, as amended by the Dash 4s, is moved to the floor with a due pass with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Closed on 98. And we'll open on Senate Bill 121.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Senate Bill 121. Yes, directs TriMet to study the feasibility of extending its max light rail system westward to the cities of Cornelius and Forest Grove, Mr. Chair. We do not have the paperwork to move this bill today, Mr.
We
Chair.
Do not?
No, not have it today.
We don't
not
have
it today.
Is there anybody want to talk on 121?
Just me.
Just you.
Mr. Chair, just a brief history, and about 2007, when I was approached to by TriMet to help them do the east side TriMet. One of the things I said to Olivia was, when are we going to do out to Forest Grove? And she said, oh, we'll probably look at that next. As you well know,
that didn't happen.
That didn't happen, and I've been talking to them ever since. And I decided that it's time to actually put in a bill instead of just talking to them and see what happens. That's what this bill is an attempt to get something done. We have a real problem in that corridor between Hillsborough and Forest Grove. Now that Pacific University has campuses in both Forest Grove and Hillsborough, And now that we have in Cornelius halfway there, we have a very large new retail store. The traffic is much worse, and we have a lot of people who would use that. And it's one of the cheapest places to build light rail in the state because they already own the right of way.
Okay.
So that's it.
That's your pitch. Is there anybody else who wishes to address this bill?
I'd like to ask you a question.
Oh, sure.
Like I said, it's late in the day, and I'm confused. But what power do we have to direct TriMet?
I don't know.
We can always try. They are a state agency.
They are?
They are.
Okay.
We close the public hearing. Do I need to roll it?
We do, yes.
Yeah, we can. You can just put it on the link. We don't need to roll it.
Okay. So we will open on Senate Bill 985. Patrick.
All right, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 985 exempts insurers that transact specified classes commercial insurance from the requirement to file rates or policy forms. Specified circumstances in which the exemption does not apply. This measure has no fiscal or revenue impact and no amendment, Mr. Chair.
You're up.
Mr. Chair, due to the Paul Cosgrove representing the American Insurance Association, in your file there are two detailed documents both explaining this bill and justifying why we think it's necessary. One is a joint statement by the American Insurance Association, National Association of Mutual Insurance Companies, and the Property Casualty Insurers of America. This is a bill to modernize the handling of commercial policies, especially specialty commercial policies for larger companies that are specially negotiated. And effectively, although it doesn't change any of the substantive requirements that these policies must have that you have adopted in various statutes, it would eliminate for the list that is in the bill, which I will talk about in just a second, is going to be changed. But for the list in the bill, it would eliminate the requirement for filing the forms and having the approval of the forms in advance and filing the rates. Again, this is a limited number of policies, big policies, commercial, expressly not including any policies to consumer insureds. We've been working with the department diligently, and they've been very helpful. We have reached agreement on some narrowing of the bill. There are some additional discussions that I think in the next day or two we will probably come to an agreement. I expect, I'm reasonably optimistic, on a bill that they can have no objection to. And so we will then bring you an amendment which will narrow the scope to those things that they are comfortable with. This is a trend that's happening in other states. New York, big insurance market, has done this for essentially all commercial lines. And the testimony in the record will reflect what other states have done. We're going to take a baby step, or at least a junior step, not a full step like New York did, but it's worked well and the states have done it, and I think it'd be helpful. So that's my thought. There's one other issue, and there's a gentleman from the Surplus Lines Association here. We're also working with them. They have a sort of a corollary issue, and we may be able to resolve that either here or on the House side, and we'll continue to work with them as well. Thank you. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Seems like you have mostly support in the file. From the associations, you have one opposition, which I assume you're working on.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Is that the Surplus Lines Association?
Yes, Red Shield.
Yes, exactly, we are.
Okay. Any questions, Paul? Okay. Roger Heebly? Back there. Please. This one sounds like we're not going to pass it out today. We're going to give them some time, so
Chair Beyer and committee, for the record, my name is Roger Helbling, and I'm the executive
director.
Sorry
for that. I mispronounced your name.
Executive director of the Surplus Line Association. My testimony, I think, has been posted on the website. Uh-huh. I know time is very short. I might say that we are an advisory organization to the State Insurance Department. We've been in existence since 1939, helping the state regulate and collect taxes on surplus lines business. Last year, we helped the state collect over $7.5 million in taxes. Briefly, surplus lines is a complement to the admitted insurance market that the AIA represents. Our carriers generally write the business that the standard carriers either will not or cannot write. This includes everything from bars and taverns to roofers, loggers, and lumbers, and most recently, virtually all marijuana-related business is run through our members in our office. We feel that the efficiencies that are being proposed through this measure by the AIA and the standard market should also apply to the non-standard or surplus lines market, and I continue to welcome the opportunity to work with the insurance department and the AIA to work on further details of this measure. So
okay.
With that, I can close, and again, I'm available for any questions.
We got about a week.
Okay, very good.
All righty.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Yes, sir.
Senator Beyer, other committee members, my name is Chris Jones, and I'm president of Red Shield Insurance Company, which operates out of Portland, Oregon, with its major operations. Red Shield is not, and I've delivered to the desk earlier my comments for your further review.
They're on file.
I skip over. Red Shield opposes the bill. The bill alludes to the notion that there is a need for more competitive market. Oregon has a healthy competitive insurance market, and this is confirmed by the fact that coverages are expanding and rates are dropping in most lines of coverage. State law 742.003 currently allows for certain lines of risk to be unregulated: wet marine, transportation, surplus, and reinsurance. And it does not allow for traditional lines produced for the general public, such as commercial property, pollution, product liability, boiler machinery, to be unregulated in the admitted market. These and other classes of risk have been regulated for some time and provide stability, uniformity, and competitive pricing for the general public. The reason for non-regulated lines has to do with tradition, complexity, severity, and more limited numbers of insureds affected. The reason for regulation is simple: to protect the consumer and to make sure companies are charging rates which are both fair to the buyer and adequate for the solvency of the company. Please do not assume that the customary lines of risk that have been regulated for some time will be better off for the buyer of insurance or the companies providing insurance if unregulated. Over time, it's most likely that these will lead to less competition, less coverage, and higher premiums. In the beginning, an unregulated market may well bring more insurance markets. Large national companies, due to spread of risk, may be able to increase market share by offering more coverage at lesser rates. Over time, the market share of a few companies will be such that there will be less competition, which may lead to less coverage at higher rates. Red Shield believes that the subject of deregulation should be given extensive thought before the matter is decided. We believe that this matter has not been properly vetted by all stakeholders, and where good revision of the current law can be implemented in the short time allowed by this current legislative session. If the state wishes to accomplish some movement on the subject, Red Shield would back the thought of classes of risk, of business or risk, that affect larger general population, Main Street business, many having less sophistication, should continue to be regulated. For the lines of business that affect larger personal or commercial entities with higher levels of sophistication, deregulation should be allowed. If the state wishes to embrace the concept of having classes of risk being available to the market on a more timely basis, the state might adopt file and use regulatory review for rates or forms and rates. The state would still oversee the forms and rate filing, which would allow after-action review. If filing is deemed unacceptable upon review after file and use period, action should only apply moving forward. Thank you for taking the time to review Red Shield Insurance Company's concerns and on such an important topic. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anybody else on this one? Okay, we're going to not move this one today. I would like some input from the insurance division. Not right now, but something I'd like to hear from you. Mr. Cosgrove, I'm going to close public hearing on 985. Paul, you're the only one here on 986. Would you mind if we rolled this to Monday? You okay with that? Okay. So we will not move that. Anything else today? Is there anything else that we need to do today? Seeing none, we are done.